Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 317, a two-parter titled AIDS, Biological Warfare, and Apartheid. This program is being recorded on July 29th of the year 2001. In For the Record program number 225, and to a lesser extent in number 228, we dealt with a doctor who committed suicide under strange circumstances in Southern California. That doctor's name was Dr. Larry Ford, and he was apparently connected not only to biological warfare research, but to elements of right-wing extremism, including some fascist elements within the militia movement, and also allegedly to the South African regime under its apartheid era, and also allegedly to elements of the Central Intelligence Agency as well. We're going to be taking up Dr. Ford's story in a big, big way in this broadcast. However, I thought that before getting into Dr. Ford's story, and in light of some of the recent material done in For the Record program 308 and 316 about the SV40 cancer-causing monkey virus and research into that, a very complicated nexus which would link the milieu of the Kennedy assassination to biological warfare research, genetic engineering, a cancer epidemic, and attempts at inoculating the American people against that cancer epidemic, I thought it might be worth starting this broadcast with some discussion of the most recent diplomatic brouhaha stirred up by the Bush administration, namely the Bush administration's refusal to ratify an extension of a biological warfare treaty. Information was carried about that in numerous papers, including the Financial Times of Thursday, July 26th of the year 2001. This is an article by Richard Wolff in Washington and Francis Williams in Geneva. It's headlined, U.S. says biowarfare deal is unworkable. And skipping down about the U.S. rejection of the extension of the biological warfare treaty, laboratories developing and producing such weapons look no different from facilities producing legitimate products such as vaccines. The U.S. says the proposed inspection regime would give ample time for those guilty of pursuing biological warfare to destroy the evidence and mask their activities. Quote, you could produce biological weapons in this office, and you could get rid of the evidence in 5 minutes, unquote, said one administration official. To underline their concerns, U.S. officials point to the failure of United Nations weapons inspectors in Iraq to detect Saddam Hussein's biological weapons operations. Against that, the Bush administration says the proposed inspections would undermine its own biotech and drugs industries. By imposing regular site visits, it says, trade secrets would be compromised under the guise of arms control. Officials also claim inspections would compromise U.S. efforts to defend itself against a biological attack, as U.S. defense facilities would come under scrutiny. However, other countries have taken the view that while the draft protocol would be no guarantee against cheating, it would enhance security by acting as a further deterrent to the use or production of biological weapons. Disarmament campaigners point out that many of the deficiencies in the inspection regime were put there at the insistence of the U.S., concerned to protect military and commercial secrets. So please note that, and note again that in addition to rejecting the Kyoto Treaty, pretty much tearing up the ABM Treaty, the Bush administration is now further alienating much of the international community by refusing to ratify the Biological Warfare Weapons Agreement. This is more than a little ironic. First of all, there are a number of strong evidentiary tributaries linking Bush's father not only to the events leading up to the probable distribution of AIDS, the probable deliberate creation and distribution of AIDS, but beyond that, there is substantive information that much of Saddam Hussein's biological weapons capabilities came from the United States, and that the chief engineer of the rearmament of Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War was none other than George H.W. Bush, or George the First, as I call him. The dangers inherent in biological warfare research I don't think need to be belabored here. I would note in passing that indeed any research into microorganisms and how they infect people can be abused, and that the distinction between offensive and defensive biological warfare research is completely academic. In point of fact, if you're studying how wee beasties infect people, make them sick and kill them, then there is no substantive difference between the two. You're either researching it or you're not, the rest is in application. Research credit on the following goes to a listener, and this article is going to occupy the duration of the broadcast. This program, this article, is from Los Angeles Magazine's issue of July of 2001. The article is called The Medicine Man, and it's authored by Edward Humes, last name H-U-M-E-S. And this article is about the aforementioned Dr. Larry Ford, or Larry Creed Ford, discussed at considerable length in For the Record program number 225 and touched on again in number 228. Who Larry Ford was and some of the things that he was involved in should become clear during the course of the reading of this article. Again, from Los Angeles Magazine's issue of July of 2001, The Medicine Man, authored by Edward Humes. The article reads in part as follows. Larry Ford was a brilliant scientist bent on saving the world from disease and misery. I would add that's open to debate. But it wasn't the Irvine doctor's lab work that spared the most lives. It was his suicide. The meeting at the Beverly Hills mansion of the South African trade attaché was unusually secretive, but Peter Fitzpatrick still managed to witness it, peering from an adjacent room through a massive shared fireplace. He watched as Neil Nobel, and I may be mispronouncing some of these names, K-N-O-B-E-L, Deputy Surgeon General of South Africa, the white-ruled apartheid South Africa of 1986, met Larry Ford, a noted Los Angeles gynecologist and infectious disease specialist with an unusual subspecialty, biological and chemical warfare. The two spoke in hushed tones, then Ford, a devout Mormon who volunteered his services to missionaries and Boy Scout troops, passed over a hefty black satchel. The meeting came to a close. Later, Fitzpatrick sat down with a boisterous trade attaché, Gideon Bauer, B-O-U-W-E-R, who could not resist explaining in his thick Afrikaans accent what had just happened. The white minority government of South Africa was in those years locked in a bloody struggle with its black citizens, willing to do anything to stay in power. Bauer's role was to thwart the U.S. trade embargo on technology and expertise coveted by the apartheid regime. Fitzpatrick, a young actor, glib and personable, were part of Bauer's informal embargo-busting team, making sure the parties at the mansion were well attended by the well-connected. Larry Ford was a regular at those gatherings, and the technology he handed over that day, Bauer chortled, could prove invaluable. A sampler of virulent designer strains, i.e., I would add that means genetically engineered designer strains of cholera, anthrax, botulism, plague, and malaria, as well as a bacterium he claimed had been mutated to be, quote, pigment specific, unquote. Quote, Kaffir-killing germs, unquote, Bauer confided, using the derogatory Afrikaans term for blacks. Again, quoting, Dr. Ford has done my country a great service. Fitzpatrick clinked glasses with Bauer and left, then called his handler at the FBI, where he served as one of two informants planted at South Africa's Los Angeles consulate. He told the FBI everything. Yet, he says, nothing was done. According to Fitzpatrick, the deputy surgeon general flew off with his suitcase full of death. Why didn't you guys stop him? He later asked his handler. The agent just stared at him. 15 years passed. Apartheid was dead. The FBI had long since lost interest in its old informant. And Peter Fitzpatrick was sitting on his couch talking with his wife, and television set muted as the evening news flashed by. Then something on the screen caught his eye. A grainy photo of a jut-jawed, narrow-eyed, round-shouldered man he hadn't seen in years, Dr. Larry Ford. He turned up the volume and heard a reporter explain how Ford, co-owner of an up-and-coming biotech firm, had become a prime suspect in the attempted murder of his business partner. That stunned Fitzpatrick, but what had him scrambling to his feet and reaching for the phone were the images that followed Ford's photo. Policemen searching the doctor's Irvine home, unprotected. Oh my God, they have no idea what they're getting into, unquote, Fitzpatrick exclaimed. It all came back to him then. Ford's talk of bioweapons and booby traps, his hoard of guns and explosives, not to mention the doctor's claims of doing dirty work for the CIA. Stories Fitzpatrick had once dismissed as a nerd's Walter Mitty fantasies, until he noted the FBI's official hands-off policy with the suitcase of germs. "I've got to warn them," he told his wife. So for the first time in many years, Fitzpatrick called the FBI, and once again, no one there seemed interested in what he had to say. I'm going to skip a section of the article that deals with the circumstances surrounding Larry Ford's suicide to make a long story short, and this is discussed briefly in For the Record program number 225. Larry Ford and his business partner, James Patrick Riley, had a firm called BioFem, and among the things they were doing was developing means of not only protecting against AIDS, but also against other sexually transmitted diseases, and they were going to be combining birth control technology with some of this prophylactic technology to protect against AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases. And one aspect of the business profile of this firm that should be discussed in the business strategy, because it's relevant to the biological warfare angle, skipping down, the profits in turn would fund Ford's true passion of the past 12 years, a secret BioFem project to develop a super antibiotic derived from what he called, quote, unidentified amniotic fluid substance, unquote. He believed it was nature's way of protecting embryos from disease, the reason HIV-negative babies can be born to HIV-positive mothers. Ford hoped to synthesize the substance, saving countless lives and earning him a Nobel Prize along the way. Well, perhaps, or perhaps there were other motives for his research. In any event, professional rivalry and jealousy grew between James Patrick Riley and Larry Ford, and Larry Ford appears to have hired a hitman to dispatch his partner. The hitman shot at James Patrick Riley, who turned his head at just the right moment, at least for James Patrick Riley. He was seriously wounded and shot through the face, but he was not killed or seriously incapacitated. Shortly thereafter, Larry Ford relieved the earth of his own presence. Skipping down in the article, then he returned home and retreated to his bedroom, where he carefully laid out a selection of firearms from his collection. He put a double-barreled shotgun in his mouth and pulled both triggers. Well, that was the end of Dr. Larry Ford. However, it was by no means the end of the significance of his life and his work, and we're going to go into that right now. Speaking of BioFem, the firm that ultimately led to the lethal dispute between James Patrick Riley and his partner Larry Ford, the BioFem case might have made the back burner then and there had Irvine Police Detective Victor Ray quit when his department and the FBI warned him to. But Ray, a former sonar technician on Navy submarines, a job that requires patience and persistence, would not give up. He steered the investigation to Ford's backyard, where men in Andromeda-strained suits would evacuate a neighborhood and haul away an arsenal of toxins, germs, plastic explosives, and guns. In the process, they unearthed a trail that stretched all the way from the CIA to apartheid-era South Africa, and Dr. Wouter Basson, B-A-S-S-O-N, the man who ran the country's clandestine bioweapons program, that country being South Africa. The question still plaguing federal, state, and local investigators is a simple but urgent one. What was Ford planning to do with his germs and bioweapons expertise? The discovery of militia movement and racist literature among Ford's papers has raised the possibility that he offered biological or chemical weapons to terrorist groups. Concerns have also mounted over a patented feature of his inner confidence suppository. That was the combination prophylactic and contraceptive device. Beginning again, concerns have also mounted over a patented feature of his inner confidence suppository, the microencapsulation of beneficial bacteria. It turns out that this architecture could double as an ideal delivery system for bioweapons, allowing otherwise fragile disease organisms to be seeded virtually anywhere. Ford, in essence, had patented the prescription for a perfect microscopic time bomb. That, says Ray, scares the hell out of everyone. Parenthetically, I would add that this particular piece of information also highlights the ambiguous nature of biological warfare research. As stated earlier, the difference between, quote, offensive and, quote, defensive research is completely academic. I would also note, and there may be no connection here, but I will also note that Dr. Garth Nicholson has done research into an apparently genetically engineered mycoplasma, which has a gene from the HIV virus inserted into it to basically give it a protein sheath, which makes it much more pathogenic. And that genetically engineered mycoplasma has been implicated in a fair amount of Gulf War syndrome, and it appears to have been given to Saddam Hussein to use against the Iranians, during the Iran-Iraq War. He appears to have used it against us. One wonders whether perhaps that microencapsulation process that Dr. Ford was working on had any connection to the genetically engineered mycoplasma that's infecting the Gulf War veterans. Skipping down. Talking about Larry Ford's long history of work for the government, and despite early disclaimers that there was no connection between Larry Ford and the U.S. government, and in turn the South African government, those disclaimers were not accurate. Skipping down. The invitation to work in the government laboratory had come from a man Ford identified only as General Wyman. He liked to show people a framed photo of the general and himself with Ford in an army uniform, though records show he was never in the military. This offer to an 18-year-old about to enter college did not seem all that unusual to Ford or his blue-collar parents. He had, after all, earned lab privileges at Brigham Young University in his hometown of Provo, Utah at age 12, according to Riley. Ford told the Rileys and others his subsequent work for the military and the CIA included research on biological and chemical weapons, consulting on Iraqi capabilities during the Gulf War, and sneaking into epidemic hot zones in Africa to gather samples of such killer organisms as the Ebola and Marburg viruses. Note again his apparent role as a consultant during the Gulf War and his work on Ebola and Marburg, both of those discussed in Emerging Viruses by Dr. Len Horowitz, both of those quite possibly genetically engineered wee beasties as well. Skipping down. Victor Ray, that's the detective, a compact man with thinning hair who has been on the Irvine police force for 10 years, initially discounted most of Ford's claims as the nutty imaginings of an unbalanced genius. It's not that Ray hadn't handled unusual cases in the past. He was the detective assigned to the headline-grabbing case in which an evil twin allegedly plotted to murder her sister and take over her life. Skipping down, once police began to search Dr. Larry Ford's residence, they came up with some very, very interesting things, and it should be noted that the apparent getaway driver for the botched assassination attempt on Ford's business partner, James Riley, was a person who, as we will see later in the article, had connections to Dr. Ford and his clandestine work for the apartheid regime in South Africa. Skipping down and resuming, police traced the plates and the van of the getaway car to an old friend of Ford's with a violent past, Dino DeSach, capital D apostrophe, capital S, double A-C-H, who was arrested that night as the getaway driver and has since been convicted of attempted murder and conspiracy, crimes carrying a mandatory 26-year sentence. His cell phone records showed him talking to Ford immediately before and after the hit from a cell location near Biofem. Biofem's receptionist remembers seeing Ford on the phone at his office window just before the shooting, with a perfect view of Riley's parking space. Police found private Biofem correspondence faxed from Ford to DeSach's South Central Los Angeles tax preparation business, along with hitman manuals, photos of Riley's parking spot, and a crude homemade silencer. Ford, by the way, was an obstetrician and gynecologist, and one of his celebrity patients was none other than the late Margot Hemingway, who apparently committed suicide or overdosed on barbiturates that she got from Dr. Ford. Skipping down. Ford graduated magna cum laude from Brigham Young University, published more than 65 articles, held numerous patents in medicine and biochemistry, had an international Ob-Gyn Award named for him, and built a patient list that included doctors and a smattering of celebrities, although one, the late Margot Hemingway, overdosed on barbiturates Ford provided. Skipping down. Once police began to search Ford's domicile, they came up with a number of interesting things in terms of some of the things that he had on him, and also some of the people that he was associated with. Only after Ford's suicide did informants start coming forward. Ray began hearing about an entirely different Larry Ford, a man who cheated on his wife, betrayed his partner, and bred super germs and was willing to use them. This was the Larry Ford who formed a close bond with Dr. Jerry D. Nielsen, a gifted Anaheim Surgeon General with extreme views and a penchant for trouble that quickly made him a suspect in the Riley shooting. Nielsen, that's capital N-I-L-S-S-O-N, who boasted of having worked as a special forces physician for the white minority government of Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, appears to have kindled Ford's interest in supporting apartheid. At the time of Ford's suicide, Nielsen was in the process of losing his license for sexual misconduct with patients, one of them a 14-year-old who allegedly became his lover for the next 15 years. Whenever the two doctors were together, it was the charismatic Nielsen who made the most lasting impression. Now 72, the surgeon was a formidable presence even in late middle age. Tom Byron worked with Fitzpatrick as an FBI informant in the South African consulate in the 1980s and spent time with both doctors. He describes Nielsen as, quote, the monster with miracle hands, unquote, a towering figure with a shaved head, Jesse Ventura as a skilled surgeon, quote, he was very fit, very muscular, the kind of guy who could knock you out with one punch, Byron says, again quoting, he told me, I've killed people in my lifetime and I have no qualms about killing again. I would never cross that man. Nielsen was not available for comment. Nielsen had long worked with Ford to amass biological and chemical weapons, and both doctors stored them openly in their homes, his ex-lover told the FBI. She sued Nielsen and won a confidential settlement after accusing him of performing unnecessary surgeries on her, including cosmetic enhancement, without her permission. She was also treated by Ford and was one of several former patients who told Ray that the gynecologist used them as lab rats, deliberately making them ill in order to test remedies. If taking a life advances scientific knowledge, Ford would tell her, the sacrifice is well worth it. The detective spoke with a Los Angeles gun shop manager, a longtime friend of Ford's who developed a complex of rare diseases, among them a chronic lung and immune system disease, sarcoidosis, that is extremely uncommon in every racial group but one, African Americans. The man is white, and he is convinced Ford had a hand in his ailment. There was a woman with cervical cancer whom Ford treated with an experimental drug that didn't work. She later required emergency surgery to save her life. Other women, Ray learned, had been given prototypes of inner confidence that were never intended for human use. All of them fell ill with a variety of vaginal infections, he says. Riley was told there was no product, that it was still being developed, but I have one in a jar sitting in my office that Ford gave to a patient, Ray says. He was experimenting, unquote. More people came forward. A former business associate of Ford said that when a mistress broke up with Ford in the early 1980s, the doctor vowed to infect her with an alpha bug, unquote, promising, quote, she will never be healthy or normal again. Authorities talked to the woman and learned that she suffered from a mysterious and incurable malady that has caused debilitating vertigo for the past 14 years. She's undergone two brain surgeries just to ease the symptoms. At least one other woman, who maintains that Ford drugged her against her will during a business lunch, has reported similar problems with chronic vertigo and complained of symptoms that resemble Gulf War syndrome, except she was nowhere near the war. So noting here that people who had in some way either run afoul of Ford or simply allowed themselves the mistake of laxity around Ford wound up, at least according to this article, being human guinea pigs for some of Ford's, quote, therapies, unquote, or perhaps being victimized by Ford's biological warfare expertise. I would also note that one woman suspects Ford of infecting her with something that gave her symptoms similar to Gulf War syndrome, except she was never near the Gulf War. One wonders whether perhaps she has the genetically engineered mycoplasma that I alluded to earlier. Continuing with this article, state and county health officials, with help from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, interviewed many of these patients, but their investigation was limited to whether there was a public health risk, such as a threat of an epidemic. They found none, and closed their inquiry, though the FBI still makes it a point to ask former patients of Ford's if they were ever unconscious in his presence, something the complaining patients all have in common. Quote, "We started to realize there was a lot more to Dr. Ford than we had first thought," says Ray. "It began to look like there might be something to the stories he told, and that the attempt on Mr. Riley's life was just the tip of the iceberg." And skipping down among the many stories that are told is this following chilling anecdote. One of the most chilling stories Ray heard came from the owner of Chantal Pharmaceuticals of Los Angeles, that's spelled capital C-H-A-N-T-A-L, a company that had developed an anti-wrinkle cream with Ford's help. She told the FBI that Ford, angry with one of her partners, went to the man's office carrying a cardboard box with a rabbit inside. He put the box on the man's desk, pulled on latex gloves, removed a syringe from his pocket, and squirted two drops of a viscous, amber liquid onto the rabbit's shoulder. It immediately convulsed and died, blood pouring out of its nose and ears. Ford, never uttering a word, turned and left, the box still sitting on the desk. Indeed, a very chilling anecdote, one that it would appear that this rabbit was infected with some sort of rapidly infecting hemorrhagic fever, perhaps Ebola. That's pure speculation, but this certainly would appear to be some sort of nasty BW weapon, and a very fast-acting one indeed, and certainly the massive hemorrhaging from the nose and ears would suggest at least the possibility of Ebola, which along with Gulf War Syndrome was one of the things that the late Dr. Ford had been researching. We're going to be continuing with analysis of this article in the second half of the program, and we're going to be going into some of the connections that Dr. Ford had, and he had many, many connections indeed. One of those was to the intelligence community, and another of those was to the apartheid regime of South Africa. I've alluded to other broadcasts that I've done in this, Those are available from a tape and CD duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. Spitfire is located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. There's a list of an annotated description. Actually, there's a list of the various programs available from Spitfire, and by the time most of the member stations that get these broadcasts hear the program, there will be an annotated description of For the Record program number 317 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, has been compiling these broadcasts on Real Audio. Those are available on two websites. More recent For the Record programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emory, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. There are other older For the Record programs, including the aforementioned programs 225 and 228, dealing with Dr. Ford and apartheid and AIDS. That address, and again, these are available for download only, they're not streaming, http://archive.wfmu.org/archive/D-X/. Listeners can hear the three-hour program that I do on KFJC-FM on Sunday night from 7 to 10 Pacific time on KFJC.org and look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. People can email me at demory@kfjc.org. That concludes Side A of For the Record program number 317, Biological Warfare, AIDS and Apartheid. This is being recorded on July 29th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.